Welcome to Writer House Literary Salon.
Welcome to Writer House and to the 2014 100,000 Poets for Change Global Event. This is a really remarkable day. Over 600 events are occurring globally, and we're part of it. It is a great joy and an honor to be here with you today. This is the fourth year, this international initiative celebrating creative solidarity, creative expression, for global uplift, for positive change. This is the fourth year that it's occurred. And as those of you who did the research and read the information from previous years, it started in 2011 when Michael Rothenberg and Terry Carrion, both of whom are... Michael is the editor and publisher of the Big Bridge magazine, or the Bridge magazine in California, and Terry is the associate editor. And they initiated this idea of inviting people around, poets around the world, to have an event, a poetry reading, on the same date. And it's grown from that first year where 95 countries participated. Now there are over 100 countries. We have over 600 events this year. And I put stars on the map marking some of the locations. Some countries I couldn't find. Some countries have multiple events occurring. We have two happening in Virginia, this one, and there's also one in Richmond. We're going to start with those of you who made pre-event reservations. I'm going to draw a name and announce your name, and then you'll come up and read. And our first reader is... Kat. Welcome, Kat.
Okay. I'm going to be reading a poem that was actually inspired by one of my friends that was abused growing up, and it's one of the biggest changes that I'm really passionate about is just the safety of the people that I love. So that's going to be what I'm reading about. Every hand you draw has shortened fingers. I wonder sometimes if this means that you have been reached for by hostile hands too many times. If you have been doused in kerosene so many times, you learned to drink it. I wonder sometimes if you have been in so many toxic relationships that you mistake anger for passion, a fist for a hand, a shove for a hug. I wonder sometimes. If you draw defenses into every situation you are in because you look around and every face holds that which abused you, I wonder sometimes. What it's like to be inside your head, I know you are trapped in this culture. It seems that if everything fosters the abuse of that which is innocent, and I'm sorry. But I have to let you know that there is hope, that you have been taught to drink kerosene, but you are a dragon. Breathe fire onto it. Fan the flames with your wings. You are stronger than this. You are too bold, too brazen, too fierce to be preyed upon. You are beautiful. You are so much beautiful strength. You defy gravity with one flap of your wings. Do not let anyone tell you you are less than beautiful. You were not meant to be held captive in this tower prison of a culture. Instead, you were meant to use its bricks as a runway, its tower as a takeoff point from which you will lift off and change the world.
Let's welcome L.M. Browning.
The piece I'm choosing to read is called The Boat Rocker. I overturned the boat once and nearly drowned. Coughing up the heavy waters, I lie limp. Rescued, part of me died in the storm. Gasping, the defiant self was the victim and the pragmatist was the survivor. A boat rocker once, I am left to fear the open waters now. Stranded on the barren island, which my trauma confines me to, I stand quietly screaming, yearning for cause to revive the wild ways, to take a stand as I once did, and fearless and fierce stand amongst the churning swells. And the second piece I'd like to read is called Measures of Devotion. The fruits of the years are not shown in certainties gathered, but the lengths we have gone in our search for understanding. When all faith is gone and the lines of the self blur into gray, our journey is our testament. The last one I'll read is called Simplicity. There are days when life is complex, and I require some answers as to the hows and whys that surround the mystical forces at work in my life. And still, there are days when life is simple, and all I need is a heavy coat to wrap around me, a sturdy pair of boots, and a bag big enough to carry my load. Those days when our suffering recedes, the gray curtain rolls back, and the beauty of what it is to draw breath pervades.
Welcome, Fred Moss.
Thanks. And I have brought poems by other people about not fitting in. First, Lee Young Lee, Self-Help for Fellow Refugees. If your name suggests a country where bells might have been used for entertainment, or to announce the entrances and exits of the seasons, or the birthdays of gods and demons, it's probably best to dress in plain clothes when you arrive in the United States, and try not to talk too loud. If you happen to have watched armed men beat and drag your father out the front door of your house and into the back of an idling truck, before your mother jerked you from the threshold and buried your face in her skirt folds, try not to judge your mother too harshly. Don't ask her what she thought she was doing, turning a child's eyes away from history and toward that place all human aching starts. And if you meet someone in your adopted country and think you see in the other's face an open sky, some promise of a new beginning, it probably means you're standing too far. Or if you think you read in the other, as in a book whose first and last pages are missing, the story of your own birthplace, a country twice erased, once by fire, once by forgetfulness, it probably means you're standing too close. In any case, try not to let another carry the burden of your own nostalgia or hope. And if you're one of those whose left side of the face doesn't match the right, it might be a clue looking the other way was a habit your predecessors found useful for survival. Don't lament not being beautiful. Get used to seeing while not seeing. Get busy remembering while forgetting, dying to live while not wanting to go on. Very likely, your ancestors decorated their bells of every shape and size with elaborate calendars and diagrams of distant star systems, but with no maps for scattered descendants. And I bet you can't say what language your father spoke when he shouted to your mother from the back of the truck, "Let the boy see." Maybe it wasn't the language you used at home. Maybe it was a forbidden language. Or maybe there was too much screaming and weeping and the noise of guns in the street. It doesn't matter. What matters is this: the kingdom of heaven is good, but heaven on earth is better. Thinking is good, but living is better. Alone in your favorite chair with a book you enjoy is fine, but spooning is even better. And Lee Young Lee is a very famous poet. Jennifer Bartlett, my second poet, may be less famous. She's in Brooklyn. She's a woman with cerebral palsy and sometimes writes about that. And this is untitled. It's in a series of poems. The book, which is new this year, is called Autobiography, Anti-Autobiography. The autobiographical parts are mostly about her impairment and its consequences in her life. I wore braces to be more like them, to be better. I went to normal schools because I was normal. I was asked to deny this movement because this movement wasn't effective enough. I was taught to walk because walking is always preferable to not walking. I was taught to walk so they wouldn't have to reform their beautiful architecture. And if I couldn't walk fast enough, it was my problem, and I was left behind. I was asked not to give birth to children because they might be like me. Those who made fun of me were told, their children would turn out like me. And this was meant to be some kind of kindness or protection. I asked myself to fit the way they thought I should, so I could have their jobs and their happy lives. And now I'm exhausted from their stupid asking, from my own stupid asking. Thanks.
And let's welcome our next reader, Tom Brown.
Sharing the art of the world is a wonderful idea. Thank you, Michael Rothenberg and Terry Carrion, for the chance to participate in this worldwide event, and Polly for the opportunity to be here in Charlottesville. I'm dedicating a story and three of my poems to the people of Susa and Tunisia and El Paso, Texas. Our similarities are greater than our differences, yet it's the differences that make the world an interesting place to live in. What would be the point of going on vacation if every place was the same? In 1752, the satirist Voltaire, during one of his exiles for ridiculing the powerful, wrote a science fiction called Micromegas. Micromegas was born on a planet off the dog star Sirius. He was like us in form, but a far greater magnitude, being 8 leagues high, which is about 24 miles tall. He had nearly 1,000 different senses and was 450 years old, according to Voltaire. Micromegas decided to take a trip through the universe in search of intelligent life. I wonder what his thoughts may have been as he rode through space on the tails of comets. The Starman Sonnet. Shall whirling sun and dancing moon unto the void surrender? The law of conservation cannot let their force abate. The binding of the worlds will keep them safe in love most tender, and love's lease hath no time or date. Sometimes too quick the lathe of heaven turns, and so the form appears untrimmed, and often form from form declines, so chance or nature's changing course is dimmed. But the lumens of the starry places shall not fade. They are the light of something larger, whether forming or in decay. Nor shall black stars cast their shade when time itself has ebbed away. The binding of the universe is love, so we too are spun from above. Eventually, Micromegas landed on Earth, and after wading ankle-deep through the oceans, he was, after all, 24 miles tall, he came upon a ship filled with philosophers and scientists exploring the North Pole. He was delighted with their intellect and reasoning, but when he was told about the troubles in Palestine, the different people wearing different hats, others turbans, fighting and killing one another to possess the land, he became enraged and told the philosophers, "I'm going there right now and will crush them beneath my feet." A philosopher tells him to withhold his anger and not to do this, for the people are not the ones at fault. It's their sultans and kings living in their palaces that have put them up to this to satisfy their own ends. Some things haven't changed much since 1752. It's complicated. Life's a scramble every day when you have ambition and want to play, but you must be dedicated to having your own way. You're complicated. Politicians fill our minds and important people with social ties, but they're overrated, selfish, and unkind. They're very complicated. Throughout the world, in every quarter, flows the nostrum of the New World Order, like asphalt oozing in a vein with a dark and spreading stain. Sell your soul to Beelzebub to join the New World Social Club. You'll be venerated and treated so fine because you're so complicated. Behind the fall of the World Trade Towers is the grip and crush of power. Those that have it never get enough. It's an underrated drug made of complicated stuff. When they crash below the ground, in complete precision, 7 levels down, it was the finest hour of Beelzebub. It was so obfuscated, so very complicated. Life seems simple in its way. We do the same things every day, and growing old, have no doubt. We've come to know what it's about. This line of reason is ablated when at last we see it's complicated. Feeling sorry for mankind, Micromegas withheld his wrath and gave them a book containing the answers to all their questions about the point of everything, then departed from Earth. When the book was opened by the director of the Academy of Science in Paris, it was found to be blank. Conversation with a coat. Names are the invisible shadows with which others clothe us and we them. the sheaths of the soul within. Like an entry in the phone book or a coat on the back of a chair, they are the outer layer. The outside of the inside is frozen in time, the present of the past and future intertwined. Memories are clothing woven from our dreams to protect us on our journey from our schemes. Conversation was a thread between us that thinned and frayed, the cloth breath bare by the games we played. Lift the handset from the cradle when I call. Please don't put your coat on the line. That would only be kitsch to pass the time. So much for the age of reason, and as for enlightenment, the word is out that Mike Omegas may come out with a sequel to his book, but sequels can be disappointing.
So Fred Wolber is our next reader.
Thank you for your indulgence in this, and thank you for organizing the whole event and the Writer House for hosting, and you all for showing up. Paint analysis. The worn-out guest room, stolen for storage, has a map of cracks on its marbled walls, an eerie room, dingy as wrinkles cradling eyes. Its secrets are family lore beyond any telling, but brittle flakes, confetti, bright hopes, gibbous moons of lullaby reds, blues, and yellows. I sand finely smooth, unkind drips painted over like neglected friends to pardon the meanness of history. The plaster is patched, primed, and the new color is mixed as bright as if that strength were needed for new vision. I will use eggshell latex this time. Though my father swore by the brush, I will roll texture to his fine linen. Use no masking tape, no drop cloth, no guide, but only the confidence I have found to welcome that stranger of whom I'm unaware. The nest for Lucy. Above the earth, I prune the apple, discover a nest woven from the field's bounty, which you might easily dismiss as weeds. I call to my granddaughter, yards along the orchard's curve, swimming in those same sedges. Come see, there is a home in heaven. She is skeptical, does not abide my hyperbole, but trusting some further adventure, skips toward me as much as raspberry canes allow. She climbs the ladder to see a strand of flowered calico shuttled among the browns and grays that makes that home more than humble. Where did it come from? She asks, not looking down. But chance has many stories, and I can only lie to her, assuming it is a badge of all caring mothers whose homey gown is rent in frightening sorrow and offered in glad sacrifice. In stitching years, she will know this ribbon of life as her own. Grandma's gift. She collects cast iron like the poems of prize winners, and from those black Griswolds, she teaches grandkids hot, sizzle, and saute. From the nest of yellowware, she eyes the one for biscuits with a craft handed down, the greedy hints of an unwritten secret. 2 cups flour, 4 teaspoons of baking powder to tease them, and together they roil a pinch of salt, butter as precious as goldfinches, and a true splash of milk. They add a snicker to recipe. Work dough like clay and count the cutter's circles to a dozen, which means 13. A snitch of each to smell, to taste the brilliant color of jam, to tell mom and dad they're measuring and mixing. They have learned the patience of timer, the rise and the alchemy, the gilding of common things. finally their adventure shared, they climb to sleep. And Grandma opens the back porch door, waves the blue striped towel, shooing crumbs to fly into the evening. That might mean a young cricket, a mouse, or fledgling survives. Thank you.
Bill Prindle is our next reader.
When I was thinking about Poets for Change, I was trying to think back to when the idea of change began to show up in my mind. So it took me back to a January morning in 1961. Mother hanging the sheets in winter. My brother tells me his pain stories, her sucking of the emotions, the deep holes that her illness, though we didn't know about it yet, must have left inside us even then. Nothing was there that was not true, but I remember how crisply the wet sheets snapped in the January wind. She hauling the basket out from the basement, me tunneling and sledding with unrehearsed joy, until she called me inside to see on TV the old poet blinking in the shattered daylight, the new president asking me, what can I do for my country? Burning a hole I could kind of feel but could not see, the hole through which new and terrible winds blew my hopes across a whole life into a whole other century. And then, work like this, maybe it's just being a writer, but failure has to be part of the equation, how we deal with never getting published, how we deal with critics being the way they are, whatever your frustrations are as a writer or as an agent for change. You know, it's very easy to get discouraged. Why do I keep submitting this stuff? Why do I keep showing up at these events? Nothing's really going to change. So this is called Setting Your Failures on Fire. Tonight, I have discovered one more way to fail, another reason for a weary editor to toss this line aside and this one too, and one more for good measure. So here you go. Take it all. Let the whole ship go down with the sensitive boy holding too much Neptune, the old man without enough Mars to get it up again. And as a bonus, take the snide one who begrudges the success of others, who wants no one else in the limelight, wants every voice to fall silent. Miserable fuckers. You are welcome to all my familiars, the too clever, the sheer music of the words piling at your feet, kindling for your stove, and here is a match. Gets me through some difficult nights. And this is a recent piece that I wrote about. I know I'm struggling with the whole idea of separation. I'm beginning to read more and more about the fundamental shift from consciousness of separation to unitive consciousness. So that's where this came from. I had to kill the tiny snake. You see, I had to kill the tiny snake before it grew terrible. But only after I severed the tiny head with my spade, studied it as a specimen, as if separation could ever be a solution, did I find out it was not venomous. But you see, not nearly as venomous as the talk showers, the fanners of harder feelings, forcing the opposing poles so far they will not come back. And yet I wind up doing nothing but asking a blessing as their hearts grow harder inside the darkness. They made the darkness, we all, even now, unknowing, feed upon. So you see, I just had to get away from the noise and the jostle, find this one chair on this one porch of this one universe among the many make my peace separate like, which, as it turns out, is not really a better way. See now, so if we keep on telling that same story, unknowing, the one that begins and ends in separation, separation as water to fishes, never spoken because never experienced as the wrong place to start from, separate bedrock reality of you and me between the Grand Canyon and the Great Divide. See, because the moment I step away to write a new story, I go all separate again. So how do I work this? To whom do I surrender? What words will lead me back to the place where wholeness is the water from which everybody drinks? So now you see why I just give up. I give you the shovel. You dig. Then you hand it back. Then I dig. Yes, into that same old darkness. No mystery there. The blade grows only more silent. No theories of excavation. Just the digging. Just the dirt. Rising up and rising up. Now you. Now me. Now we. See, now that's the way I think it's meant to be.
And let's welcome Bill Cipher.
All writers know that works have a triggering subject and then a controlling subject. The triggering subject for this poem is Japanese beetles. The controlling subject is, you'll find out. It's called Artisans from Abroad. Such nerve, these tiny pests that make a meal of our yards. Some bugs chomp holes in leaves. Some leave nothing but the stems. But one invader dines artistically. Decked out in metallic green and coppery wings, they move in beauty, alighting on juicy airstrips, the leaves of certain trees, crepe myrtles and young sycamores, and begin sucking out the chlorophyll. Left behind, a stunning filigree of brown leaf veins. The leaves are mere starters. Fancying dessert, they move on to sugary blooms, seductive flowers on the myrtles, and succulent red roses. But beetles Japanese do more than ravage leaves. They ravish others of their breed. While some gather in the green, others mount them, sparking the next generation. In their flagrante delicto pose, they resemble double-decker bugs. The bottom deck, indifferent to love, continues gorging, like mistimed smoking while engaged. The top deck, bent on sex, seems heedless of his non-effect, each to its own happy meal. The beetle's beauty is beguiling, but I side easily with the blossoms and come girded with an execution bowl of soapy water. A sharp rap on any branch where they are feeding plunges them into the hell broth. In seconds, they are dead. Those who are copulating are still connected in the lethal water, answering the age-old question, there is sex after death. Afterwards, at some remove from the execution chamber, I ruminate about their name. We mostly blame outsiders for our woes. Winter storms descend from Canada. El Nino and La Nina rile us equatorially. Hurricanes pin it on the South Atlantic. Hong Kong and Asian flus come from over there, of course. Immigrants bring disease. These beetles originated in Japan. It's only accurate and fair to dub them Japanese. Not so fast, dear xenophobes. Naming is an exercise of power. There are many ways to label something besides where it began. If we ask the Japanese, they likely would object, as would we. If some pestilence, winged or microscopic, or some rampaging storm originated here, then rack the nations of the world who called it Scourge Americano. This one is called On Edinburgh's Steps. Once I gave to beggars, not out of goodness or of guilt, but pained imagination. I could be one of them. I saw him there on Edinburgh's ancient steps that lead up to the Royal Mile, a princely strip. Homeless, his flimsy sign announced, he sat legs out straight on a cardboard square, his Scottish tartan neck scarf too stained and dirty to divine his clan, a fact that matters in that land. Buffered thus against the cold, his back against a black iron fence, he seemed a man behind bars, imprisoned by his penury. A thin old terrier stretched beside him, grizzled like its owner, cold but asleep, heedless of his fate. The man had bear enough to feed himself. Why would he have a dog? But isn't it a far, far better end to die from hunger or from cold than to die without a friend? Well fed and warm in my fleece-lined coat, I passed by him and began to climb the stairs. Then I glanced back. I had a job, a home, a family. He has none of this. I stepped back down to him and dropped a pound note in his hat, and he said plainly, "Thank you." Our eyes connected briefly. At the top of the stairs, I turned to see him far below. His tiny figure set me musing. Will I give again to him tomorrow? Will I still? Next week? Next year? I fear the longer that I live, well fed and warm, the less I will imagine I could replace him on that cardboard square. Some agency will surely intervene. He'll not be here months from now. My coat insulates me from the cold. My long, well-fed life insulates me from his pain and his future. Thank you.
And let's please welcome Jamie Reeser.
I'm going to start with one from a collection called Note to Self, Poems for Changing the World from the Inside Out. So this one is called Callings. Do you hear yourself being called to places that are far away, beckoned by landscapes intimately known and unimaginable? Does it feel like only strangers can speak your name? You must leave home. You must leave home. Escape the walls of your upbringing any way you can. Caterpillars do it. Travel far and wide, get lost, be robbed over and over again. Realize the world is big. You are small. Forget who you believed yourself to be, who you thought others thought you were. Become someone who can't answer simple questions like, what do you do? Fail. Totally and completely fail to reach your intended destination, though carrying a map and compass. You are where you need to be the moment you give up on all the landmarks. Sit down and cry out all your laments. Cry out the laments all your ancestors feared to cry. You are indeed walking in circles, downward, inward, along a path marked grief and despair that leads directly to soul. You have arrived. Arrived at the place you began, that it killed you to leave. There is no entrance, no exit, never was. When people ask you to tell the story of your travels, your journey, of the road you have taken, do so by living your life ecstatically. Now you are here. This one's from a collection entitled Sacred Reciprocity, supporting the beloved in everyday life. And this one's entitled The Nightingale. The nightingale presses her soft, feathered breast into the spike of the thorn, penetrating her own aching heart as her song dies at sunset. Or does she? What if, instead, the nightingale melodes her melancholy into the world's most lovely verse, so strong and convincing in the depth of its sincerity that the rose sheds its thorns into the previous season's leaf litter and raises its most fragrant blossomed branch skyward as a throne for her to perch on as she sings her heart outward at sunset. Self-inflicted wounds are an option. So too is the courage to feed pain as a holy sacrament to truth and beauty. Only the latter speaks to love. I know birds well enough to believe the nightingale's song emerged from swallowing whole the ancient sorrows of the wounded feminine, gestating them around the turns of the great spiral and gifting them back to the world in newborn form. This is not lost power, but forgotten power. Well, not completely forgotten. Within you, there is a nightingale and there is a rosebush. You've been referring to them as all the things that you long to manifest, but have been afraid to deserve, because a woman you respected once showed you how to lean into thorns, and you believed that's how it had to be, always. This poem is here to say that's not true. These words are a song that came to me on the rose-scented breeze one evening at sunset, carried in a voice that my blood knew as kin. It was a sound produced across the lactating vocal cords of remembering woman. Remembering. Remembering to me her primal ties to the innate courage to embody life. For so many generations, we have been dying at our own hands. It's time to step clear of the thorns, isn't it? You've been sensing this too, I know. When Remembering Woman asked me what she could do to help, I asked for my own song, a song likened to the nightingale's most lovely sunset song. I was absolutely sure this would do it. She said to me, "You've been singing it all along, dear girl." "Oh?" I replied. "Yes," she went on. "But now you must believe in what you sing. That's the difference between being a girl and a woman. A girl knows the words. The woman knows within her what they mean." And so at sunrise, that's the choice I made, to admit that I know what my own song means. The rose bush blushed when it heard me say it out loud. I figure that's a pretty good place to start. And this is a last one from the most recent collection, which is called Wildlife. For those of you that are familiar with the Wildlife Center of Virginia, $2 from each of this collection goes to support the environmental education outreach and wildlife medicine that they do for animals not only in Virginia but around the world. And this is a seasonal piece. How many of you all have seen caterpillars on the road in the last couple of weeks? Yeah, it's caterpillar season. And then there's the stink bug. That's a whole other poem. So this one's called Swerving to Miss Caterpillars. In the autumn, when 13 segments, fat and bristled, dare the frenetic roads to find tall, dry grasses in which to sleep themselves into something utterly different, caterpillars can be your prayer. What kind of person do you choose to be? every moment of every day, you have this question put before you by everything around you and everyone. In the instant in which you wake up, how will you emerge? Driving down Route 33 at this very moment, I make a choice. I choose to be the kind of person who swerves to miss caterpillars.
Jason Kirky.
And this first poem is called Fishing with Heron. Book is Estuaries. Come into the reeds and rushes. There is work to do. Thunder through sky pours rain like rivers on the earth. I will stand as the heron stands, body poised like lightning, watching the day, my fish, a meditative gaze on all the things we could or cannot become. I caught no fish. The river instead caught me. Near full moon through clouds, a sparse prose, veiled and unveiled like a tide, the rain still comes down, work enough for a day. And this next one is called Thoreau's Cabin. Walked into Walden Pond, really into it. The body upright among its lapping tongues and eddies, dragonflies in the sun, like flames to light a fire in the waves. I stand with minnows, in wildness, the preservation of the world. There is a wild vernacular. Hush, wash, the wind plays the world as music. Every blade of grass is singing sacraments of the sun. The lake says nothing. The pebbles are quiet. Its muck and soggy leaves have taken vows of silence. The water is Tai Chi still. And the air, for all its stirring up of song, says only what the trees will let it. So the world will speak its name instead. Walked out of Walden Pond, I can say nothing more. This one is called 21 Ways to Birth a Heart. Today is a day for giving up. Tomorrow, for whatever comes after dying. No need for cliches about love and courage and soul or the faith we have in the nature of stars. No. Today is a day for human no nature. Yellow and orange and red. The feel of fallen leaves on naked skin. Somewhere in the branches of rain, there is a feathered song signifying nothing but wren. So too, you, in your nudity, stripped down of meaning like milkweed on the wind, impregnating the air with your presence. There are at least 21 ways to sing whatever name you will have on your lips tomorrow. 9 of them sound identical to silence. And the rest, well, there's no need yet to go into that. I'll read one more called Who Will Eat This? This compost from which I came, to which, like lines of poetry that feed the culture, fed by water and plants, the winged and legged, I too feed the earth and decompose, break down, rot, fertilize, decay. So much for the summer sun, apples on trees or the dew hanging like crystals on leaves. All things return to you. Not a thing will be spared. Not the oak, maple, and pine, neither wren, robin, or crow. Not the fox and deer. Not this poem. Not even the woman I love. Everything is forfeit to the damp fungal mycelia of soil, rich with earth scent, the voice of the dead still speaking. The rain falls upon the detritus of decomposed lines, once flesh and bone and singing. Drips from the branches and leaves, a baptismal for the holy fruits to come, spoken in the common tongue of mushrooms and moss, sorrel and sprouts. even as the ink of this poem sinks into the page, the paper fades, dampens, decays. What vegetables will it become? Who will eat this? Who will drink the vitality of change? Who will fruit, flower, and seed? What use are poets in times of need?
Erica. The first poem that I'm reading is a couple of years old. The instructor, and I actually wrote it here, the instructor asked us to write a political poem. And it was actually kind of funny for me because up to that point, I didn't know what it meant to work on a poem because poetry had always come so very easily to me. So as soon as I had this assignment, I had to work on a poem because I had so much that I wanted to say. So this particular poem is entitled Rehunga Takapau, and I am massacring the Maori language when I say this. It's a ritual performed when Maori warriors in New Zealand return from battle and require the taboo upon them to be removed. Many Western nations do not have such rituals for returning warriors. We know what to do with the dead. The broken scare the living hell out of us. Cracked skulls, splintered orbitals, mangled flanges, pitted, popped, burred, but not obliterated. The ones who come back chase us in the daylight. We assuage them with shiny things and loud platitudes. Greenbacks stuffed into frangible hands, dropped coins at titanium feet. We, the untouched, begging indulgences of denial, paying for forgiveness from the returned. This next one is kind of fun. The world is flat. The world is flat. There be dragons at the edge of Richmond Road and long-leggedy beasties beyond I-64, where the asphalt falls off. The Shadwell Bridge needed fixing because of the trolls, hunched as they were, cracking concrete and iron. The goats got overtime, buttressing the trusses. What? Your mother didn't tell you this? About things in the night kitchen? She didn't tell you of the Raven Master who chases the great gray man, obsidian flakes falling into Meacham's River when they chipped away at the ragged mountain. She didn't tell you of the wild things at the border of this world. She wanted you to know what is true, not what is real.
Afternoon. Thank you, Polly, for doing this. I'm going to do a hip-hop one. Actually, these two poems will be, I'm proud to say, in a collection in early 2015 by Laughing House, Laughing Fire Press, and the title of my collection is Cut on the Bias. No sense, nonsense. It's hip-hop. Try as I might, do as I should, look past the facts, would if I could. Nothing matters, I'm one in a crowd, it's not my doing, no fault allowed. War after war, load and reload, faceless bodies, hatred explodes. Centuries bleed one to another, righteous cause hides greed, the crusher. Ancient Rome and Greece lived by wars, bloodbaths in Europe and African shores. Brits, Italians, Spanish, Portuguese, treasures from natives they took with ease. Modern combat, more of the same, noble and just only in name. Nuclear bombs and chemical warfare, stakes made higher. Death everywhere. Jihad, radicals, Syrian rebels, Korean plutonium, Chinese generals. Ain't it awful? Say pointed fingers. Good and bad guys. Fake justice lingers. Non-war protests, my youth's soup du jour. Believing right from wrong, we were cocksure. No longer savvy, can't see what to do. Death lives on, awaits me and you. I wrote this piece because, 1964, when I graduated from high school, was the first year of Vietnam, which went on for 20 years. And it's like, you know, all my life. I was born right after World War II, and I'm still in war, including the bombing that started a day or two ago. So I was thinking about the kids. And I'm thinking about the kids in Africa with Ebola, and the kids in Palestine, and the kids in Mexico, and this came out of it. It's called Lost Innocence. In the deadening stillness of ceasefire, little Abdul looks for his toys in the rubble. Basira digs for simple trinkets, coveted in a box under her bed, in nameless bits and pieces once called home. Yasmin, 6, in Gaza City, has endured 3 wars in her lifetime. She wonders, without emotion, where she will lay tonight. Awake or asleep, she lives the fear of wolfish wounds and worse. These children are lucky. 4 cousins playing near the harbor, 2 brothers in a taxi with grandma, 1 4-year-old and his 8-year-old brother inside their house, a 3-year-old playing with dad in the family garden, and a boy and father going to the mosque, all died before this brief pause in the war. Families force sons and daughters to make their own luck, far away from the gang, drug, and murder threats back home, south of the American border. Middle child Jose negotiates life or death threats just on the promise, no guarantee of a safer path. Yet some in the States don't welcome extra mouths to feed. Fearing illegals have Ebola, increasing Americans call for a bigger lock on our border door. Youthful refugees have no home, at home or here, like the powerless African youth without real shelter from Ebola. Young global nomads find no safe haven from air attacks, street violence, infectious disease, or contagious prejudice. They bicycle bombed out streets, kick rag balls outside makeshift medical tents, feed beat up dolls with pretend food to play out their fate. Thank you.
J.K. McDowell.
Thanks to Writer's House. And I'm going to read from my collection, Night, Mystery, and Light. This is a collection of guzzle poems, which is a Persian form adapted to English. And each poem is 6 stanzas long. And also each stanza has a standalone as an individual poem. So there's a lot of leaping that goes on. The final feature of a guzzle is oftentimes the last stanza, the last word in each stanza is the same word. And so I'll start with one that follows that form. This is called The Divine Dream. When I first met Randolph Carter, we were tourists, Americans who had lost their way in a strange land. The reveal, that soft, moonlit terrain, was your dream. I have crossed swords with many poison-tipped blades, not always victorious, but always making art. With these words in mind, to sleep, perchance to dream. Are your lips true? So much in our world has become plastic, virtual, synthetic, simulated. I know just to be able to kiss you would make real this dream. Are you awake? The fatigue stretches the sinews, and so much is out of proportion. One drop too many of this antidote, and I will never dream. James, your moonlit scribblings must cease for now. The healing need is for the imagination to bleed into reality. Close your eyes and just dream. These words are a failure. I can only ask your patience and blessing that these poems might someday make clear some gesture, some dance in the divine dream. Thank you. This one's called Not Emptiness. An easy climb, the gecko scales the window screen. The kitchen light beckons to winged delights, and the nighttime snack fills an emptiness. We know that Hamlet ends badly. Why do we watch the play? The moment you leave the room, the balance tips as they rush to flee the emptiness. The sound of the bat striking the fastball recalls the sentence of an impromptu firing squad. The silence is shattered. Feel the emptiness. What can you see with this golden citrine eye? Beyond the scenery of darkness and despair, a vista of blooms florid through the emptiness. Walking through the spider lily and jasmine, many things we remember, many things we regret. Do not let the heart be scarred by emptiness. You have told me that the glass is for drinking. Sometimes, Jim, you spill over a fragile fallacy. Staying thirsty is abundance, not emptiness. This is called The Envelope. I was not untimely ripped like Macduff. The doctor turned me twice, but I insisted on emerging feet first. Still, I have a charmed life. If visible, the poison darts might have blocked out the sun. Our ideas of happiness can be so different, and sources of light numerous. There is a thought that propels us forward. Undiminished by scorn, she steps forward to claim the soul's rightful place. Where is your praise? The way ahead asks us that we restitch this constant unraveling. I see all these forgotten needles and wonder at the numinous cloth. There is some anger in unfinished things. Your search for inspiration has not led to many casualties, but there are teeth marks beneath the flesh. Where are you, dreams of tomorrow? Your escape in question, my letter stamped, return to sender, the golden key still sealed in the envelope. Thank you.
Jonna, Lee.
I want to thank you, Polly, first of all, for putting this all together. The first one is also a caterpillar poem. Even the ones born to be butterflies. On the sidewalk, 100 caterpillars, yellow striped like bumblebees, plummet wingless and shrinking to black nothings on the hot brick, kamikazes that will never know the blue of freedom, inching their mortared way to the street, the ignominy of asphalt, or along the foundations of the front doorstep without ever being invited in. I wonder if they look up even once in their dying and see the stratified clouds dividing the September sky like spread ribs, if they imagine wings. And the second one is called There Are Depths and Depths. Not long past, I came closer to thinking about God than I had ever, so I went, searching the scudded horizon for mare's tales, for some love poem written in the mysterious language of channel markers and hid in the glowing twilight ferried wake between here and where the world ends, and I wonder if I will find you there. And following from that, we spent a weekend not long ago, a rainy weekend, on a small, in a small fishing village on the North Carolina coast, and it just felt, it really did feel like the edge of the world. And this poem is called Other Consequences of a High Water Table. Raindrops cling to low-slung graves, each soul dead without a fear of drowning. Lichen covers tree limbs and lick yard. Time is slowed to the speed of waves. This is a no-wake zone, I joke, as we drive through standing water. The big houses on stilts, but the funeral home flush with the marshes. I wonder if where they turn on their flat screens with remote flicks from sofas sagged down by the stains of so many salt-damp years, they listen to the news of ISIS and Middle Eastern wars and missing college students and feel like they're from a different world. Or if they think of dark waters and that there are worse ways to die. Thank you.
Susan.
This is this poem. There are a couple of people here who've heard this before. I apologize if it's... Well, anyway, it's a kind of an elegy, if there can be an elegy for a place. And it's also a, something about life. It's called Entrain to New York. It starts out easily here in Charlottesville, as if we're children going on excursion. The conductors are polite, a hand with bags, assigned seats, couples first. It's the golden age of railway again, and we glide out of the station on greased wheels serenely into lush Virginia countryside, where innocent-looking towns are content to let their downtowns edge the level crossing. Green parks, red brick department stores, restaurants with cafe curtains and low windows, as if we could maybe stop a while, have coffee, watch the trains pass. But everything changes in Washington. New engine, new crew, new crowd, new scenery. The backside of Baltimore, its ruined walls, complex graffiti, and the stacked porches of its tenements. We're all grown-ups now. This route has no pity to show anyone. A moment by the broad, calm bay, and here's Wilmington, its bright windows claiming everything is fine. Then Philadelphia, where everyone looks tired. Trenton, with its blind facades, is just a punctuation on the way to Newark, that city of unholy ends. Now comes the fast dash across the Jersey Flats. Is this where we used to spot the Twin Towers? Its skyline rising in the mist was almost like some welcome to New York. Remember how that first year we rushed the windows for a glimpse? of empty space, not so much now. Time to take the bags down. Time to face Penn Station and its dogs. Thank you.
Mary Burns.
Thanks, Polly, for your enthusiasm and all your time. I really appreciate it. I've been thinking a lot lately of habits, small habits, and how fortunate I am to be able to enact my habits. So just a couple short poems here. A pair. He is her handyman. She is his cook. He is her gardener. She is his bloom. He is her callus. She is his weight. He is her voice. She is his gloom. He sharpens her mind. She softens his point. He drives home their story. She glances askant. He names the big family. She draws out the few. He dwells in the past. She waters her plants. He naps after lunch. She sleeps well past 8. He writes in his journal. She reads later on. His anger is mystery. Her forgetting is pain. The door jamb is fixed, and the pie is well made. This next one is really about a coping mechanism, which when I think about this big topic, sometimes I know I can cope if I have a good coping mechanism. I make my bed. Inspired by County Cullen's, I have a rendezvous with life. When I was young, I made my bed. Sheets pulled neat, the cover spread. I learned to read, to write, to sing, then fashion days with serious things. The years have passed, and time is strange. What is pleasure? Hard to gauge. To plan, to share, or dream the way, to write my world and charge my day. I make my bed the exact same way, shape and comfort against the fray. Showers of words that bloom or falter, a promise held at day's end, shelter. The bridge from childhood, fibrous and patched, mending my world with words untapped.
Anyway, the thing about change, I think about change a lot because I can't do it. So I hope everybody else can. This is called Tale of the Tortoise and What Value Is. You may call me crazy, what I call myself driving home, stopping to pick up a tortoise from asphalt, an image of its pancake shell strewn with gore, not part of my mental direction. A better place might be furnished within what is surveyed as mine. So here I am, one hand on steering wheel and the other clutching a hard reptile, its forelegs clawing, head spasmodically jutting. I think I might get bitten or bacterially poisoned while navigating my writhing mountain road, making sure to swerve away from neighbors' cars that suddenly appear. I wave with turtle in greeting. Now the face and feet stay pulled inside the boxy shell. I kept telling my stony ward, "We'll be there soon, please don't bite. A new home's around the next twist." Into the driveway, car parked, I'm out without a scratch. You remain tightly boxed as if suddenly fear is understood. I select the perfect spot, crowded with perky blanched shoots and flickering shade will keep you damp, not too wet, below this huge mock orange. I pray to Mountain, the cat, won't figure out how to eat you. I'm sure he can't. but am I positive? By nightfall, each stumpy leg won't get snatched, head gnawed until eyes and neck sheath become bloody nub, to peek from between sandwich shell, clawed within feline etchings. Not even a tail left as a final comma. Hope I did right. I linger to see if one leg, two, then a slow rush for cover. Yet no extremities protrude, no head pushes forward curiously, just the rune-patterned carapace resting in shadow. Nothing animate but a small breeze and my cat meowing, tail like a question mark. Hurry, I urge the rescued turtle. Still nothing, as if stone. I wonder if I have upset the balance of to be or not. What else to do but shrug my shoulders and hope a tortoise wife has not been wronged, that a cat prefers birds and rodents. I see an eastern box turtle bite emerging cucumbers in my garden tomorrow, unaware of my crazy need to witness in its life my own value. Sorry, I botched up the end. Okay. This is a short one. It's called Timeless, which isn't true. Timeless. To pass away the hour, I will question a stone rising from my murky pond, solid in water. Wait for an answer I can hold in the bottom of my palm. Wish away minutes. Drop the pebble of thought to oblivion. Watch ripples without solution to my question. I walk away, no different than I was a moment ago or am now. Slate eyes, liquid heart, windy breath struggle for transformation to thrash me with wings like a raven fleeing from darkness. Told you I can't change. And this is the final one, and I just picked this because it's sort of apropos to time and changes. Autumn advice. This time of year, not always clear-cut red and orange. A yellowing, a brown curl, loss of green more actual. Snow waiting within clouds chills the underwings of slow-circling vultures, eyes downward, searching lost crossings. Use caution, which footpaths to track when seeking the way worn strongly by walk. Watch starlings for signals. Step aside for camouflage men wearing stale faces. Fires burn dull in still-winded leaves. Send smoke to reveal unspoken names for Jesus, Buddha, Allah, Shiva. For mothers, walk quietly through rustling ground, dodge acorns pelleted from highest oaks, stay away from shadows that don't shift as daylight gets wolfed down by darkness. Winter approaches. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan, and Sigrid for staying.
I'm going to have to leave soon.
I know you are, so I'm honoring Susan's request that I read, and then we'll open up again for others who'd like to read a second time. Out of shadowed wings, in silence, a noble man humbly walks a cavernous stage, anonymous until fingers touch the guitar neck and his face lifts into light. First note, primal song, wingspan of utterance, blending languages, traversing cultures, scaling sorrow into hope. On soft red seats, hips beg to wiggle, within an ocean of bobbing heads, toes tap. The voice that rallied uprising now resounds a brighter future. Precise tones resonate healing. Vital essence soars through this man. Wearing a crown of forgiveness, He keeps time sliding, left foot in a half circle, breaking into dance, spins joy. Everyone has a pulse. If you are human, he says, Ubuntu is for you. Ubuntu comes from South Africa, and many of you may be familiar with the word. And Vusi Mahalasila has performed here in Charlottesville several times since I moved to the area. And he's a South African musician, and his education was funded by Nadine Gordimer. And he was one of the South African musicians who really helped with the ending of apartheid and also with the regeneration of the South African culture. He also played and sang at the Olympics, and he's an amazing presence.
The African.
Mm-hmm. Postcards from in the North Carolina Smokies. An unplanned turn leads us over a mountain as light snow in late April accumulates on tin roofs of abandoned roadside stands. Memories tense my friend's mouth as we near her grandfather's house, past the casino, the family reunion motel, a familiar street sign, ancestral, untraveled. Lines are blurred now, oral history disrupted, words changed in languages, records list wives only by first foreign names. Everyone wants to believe somewhere, someone related. Since I last passed through this town, the lizard man's sideshow tent's been replaced by a pink cinder block rooftop zoo offering photos with bear cubs. Two blocks down the street, a snake adventure waits in a strip mall. Snake easily sheds what no longer fits. None of the road signs make sense. No one's in the tourist information center. In this territory, spider brought fire to humans. Bear taught us which plants heal and how to dream true. Grandmother, I saw a bee enter a bloom of pink mountain laurel and carry out golden coins. Golden coins is a term used by beekeepers for pollen. Some beekeepers. Wheel dance. Mist slips beneath our bare feet. We stretch arms to hold hands. Step right, counting universal beats. Left, turn and turn again. Palms rise, meet. As the hub, we spiral small as circles and fractals. Clasp hands, step and step again. Seasons pass out of self into Earth's pulse. Meet, turn, and turn again. Fluid in symmetry, heartbeats here, soul slap rhythm, lifting us out of thought. No one noticed exactly when we became a wave. We could be a galaxy. We may be secrets in your future. We are all who have been, all who will follow. On this humid mountain, night wind rattles wisteria seed pods. Heed the owl. How about Bill Prindle?
Given the sort of cause-related nature of this event, I'm moved to say a piece of William Stafford's that I just memorized years ago because it just...
Wow.
It's like, this is why I do the kind of work that I do. It's called A Ritual to Read to One Another. Which, if you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, then a pattern others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug it lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade, each elephant holding the other's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and perhaps the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs but not to acknowledge the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or else a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The words we use, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. So I have one piece I want to read of mine, which is, I'm going to call this a physics poem. So the new physics has fascinated me for years, quantum theory and all that. And I've been reading about, you know, the Higgs field and the Higgs boson. And this guy, Peter Higgs, is basically a scout physicist, you know, came up with this idea that may actually have something to do with the unified field. And so I was like, okay, well, that sounds really cool, but what do I do, you know? So the way they explore it is through like the Large Hadron Collider, which is this massive oval under the Alps. I've never been there. I'll probably never get in there. So I tried to write a piece that helped me understand or gave me a way of connecting to this idea. It's called Walking with Higgs. I'm beginning to believe the radiance that comes in moments struck wordless by dark materials denser than the white pines rising behind the house may be the same as the terribly small thing he has sought for so long. Perhaps it lives in the field, inside the meadow we bush hog every year to hold the space for these risen things, to greet one another's solitudes, milkweed to aster, beak of meadowlark to snout of vole. Perhaps it is a field seen only through cloud mysteries at the end of the great curve, circling for miles beneath alpine stone, hurling what is known only through equations into collisions of creation, trying to chivy off a droplet of that silence before it vanishes among the blue spruce holding their sweet dark cones all year. Perhaps on a weekend we can walk down through the meadow effortlessly into that field, and if we say little enough, an exceedingly tiny awakening may blossom up unassisted in the alfalfa or in the poplar crowns or in what the river says when we listen. Thanks.
Joanna?
This is one of my favorite poems to read. It's called Chemistry Lessons. There is salt, and there is salt. What's the difference, my father asked me at dinner the other day, between sea salt and table? And I said, sea salt is less strict, Dad, more complicated. But I don't know if that's right. Don't know its biochemical makeup, how late it lets its daughters out at night. Chemicals aren't all latchkey and angle, you know. For instance, there are some in the brain more sensitive to love than to cocaine. I've heard this, that chemically love is the most powerful addiction. Crazy women need brave lovers, the poet said. This I know also to be true. I've seen crazy. But I don't know their chemistry either. Not love or crazy. My professor used to wear unmatched socks. His eyes were the color of sea glass. He taught the breakup of salts. He told my father once I was the most impressive he'd ever had, and I could have loved him then, but I was too addicted to my own heartbeat. That rhythm is less biochemical than electric. A crazy drummer in my head banging Morse code to my chest. I hope he is brave, or at least wears unmatched socks. Too much salt can muck it all up, cause heartache, like breathing in sea glass. How long can you hold your breath underwater? My cousin and I used to swim in the lake by my grandparents' house, catch turtles on cane poles with bits of old bread. The biggest ones we dragged up onto the shore, and my father sliced her neck while her jaws were clamped onto the back handle of an old broom. That was before I knew chemistry. Or love. Or that guilt could be as addictive as cocaine. I'm not sure if this is true, but I have seen crazy. Turtles, the poet said. Turtles all the way down.
Bill Seifert.
The references to chemistry and physics put me in mind of a story about Werner Heisenberg. As you know, he was the one who discovered the principle of uncertainty that you can't know simultaneously both the position and velocity of an object, of a particle. The story is he's driving home. He had discovered this. He was sure he was right. The policeman chased him. He was going at high speed to home to tell his wife. The policeman stopped him and recognized him. Dr. Heisenberg, do you know how fast you were going? And Heisenberg said, I don't, but I know exactly where I am. This one's called I, Sperm Donor. It's not autobiographical, though somebody who heard this poem thought that it was. I, Sperm Donor. Alone, twice a week, in an antiseptic cubicle, I have fathered 20 children. I get myself revved up, aim into a tube that's whisked away, frozen and labeled 150, the stuff of life, or half the stuff anyway. $50 for a minute's jerkings off, not bad. Frankly, it's surreal. I'm feeling silly, a little giddy, a little guilty. I'm ejaculating puns, cliches, and plays on words. Just listen to me. I'm not sowing my wild oats. I'm planting them one by one. I'm practicing family planting. No, I'm sending them off one by one. That's why we call them offspring. As you can see, my other organ's better at creating. I sign on to a donor registry, said I was 6 feet tall, had blue eyes, liked drama, music, philosophy. Who could ask for anything more? Even frozen, my sperm was hot stuff. Orders poured in. I know. Donor's a misnomer. I gave for money, not for love. Call it consensual, non-sensual, whatever. Not a union, but two acts split in time and space. Safe sex without a bang or a whimper. My deposit's all perfectly legal, perfectly anonymous, perfectly joyless. I'm not so heartless as I sound. Sometimes I think about the far end of the deal. Some she in missionary pose on an examination table receives my thawed-out sperm from a clinician, not a lover, with cool clinical detachment. No warming engorged tissue, no heavy breathing, or lovely shudder in her loins. It's Valentine's Day, and a twisted takeoff of a song in Paul Simon's Graceland album jangles in my head. If you'll be my Valentine, I will be your long-lost dad. I can call you daughter. Daughter, if you want to, you can call me dad. I've triggered lives with spurts of sperm, but don't know where it went or who became of it. I must find out. Someday offspring might want to know who want to answer who's your daddy with a cutesy 150. What have I wrought? A covey of half-sisters and half-brothers? Do they look like me at all? Think like me at all? I'd like to know. And when I meet them, what will I say? They were commodities, and I was paid. So what will I say? How do you greet half your chromosomes? Thank you.
Erica?
Witness tree. I am the anchor, the point at which artillery shell and flesh converged. They marked me with Minet's ball, and when I bowed, reaching for the creek, trumpets croaked under cannons' bleat. They carved notches in my uncle's bones. Bubbled bark flayed into crosshatch walls, lacerated for oblique fire. Mama's heart lies under a red steeple, her fingers broken and burned for light carried by an angel. My sister's spool turned chestnut legs and flat round face, charmed men made old by killing the thing they loved. They carried her off in triumph, held up on a pedestal behind glass doors. It should have ended there, but I remember. Rua, Rua, Roja. Those were actually three different words for redhead. She said that if I went, I'd not come back. She said the heathered hills would be my home. She said the light would hold my soul, wrapped in tartan plaid. Crags and Cairn Gorm's gray glass locks where swift hounds and selkies roam. Dreams with candles and fairy flags, a haunted mountain where the gray man waits, wildcats hide and white-tailed eagles rove. Argyle, Sutherland, and Agincourt, no fear, never forget, October child from that day to this. Chase the lion's crag and tail on Margaret's rock, touch my hand to the iron-bound door, look back to Arthur's seat, and it's down I am on my knees, so small. She said that if I went, I'd not come back. She said the pipes would call me home. She said the night would cradle me in stars.
I think of the sea turtle as a positive symbol of life, and so I have a couple sea turtle poems. The first one is called Home. Time hangs heavy upon the sand, sun striking at last the hour for the hatchling turtle to leave her leathery egg. In the ruck of 200 million years, it hasn't forgotten which way is up. Climbing out of the gritty crib, it flounders through the sand. Without a moment's indecision, the turtle chooses sides, leaves the land where it came from, in a flipper scurry to the incoming tide. Through pecking beaks and snapping claws, then plunging in the surf, swims in the sea as in eons before, now dodging shark instead of plesiosaur. Sea turtle roams in the Gulf Stream current with shrimp and seahorse for accompaniment. But in its shell, it's solitary, its carapace for home, swimming across the watery reaches alone. To a sea turtle, this makes perfect sense. The journey is its recompense. Then passing over lost Atlantis, heads for high Brazil, remembering back to when the earth was new and wonders, when so much has changed, why does a turtle remain a turtle still? This poem is called Sea Turtle. And this was, I had a pulmonary embolism and was in the hospital for a week. And I kind of polished this poem because, of course, sea turtle is always coming up for air. And when it's difficult to breathe, the sea turtle seemed like a good image to focus upon. Let go of the moment, like turtles at the bottom of the sea, whose lungs are spent and ache for air. Unable to hold on any longer, rise from the depths toward the surface. With necks outstretched, they breach the cover of wavering light and inhale the ocean breeze. Old memories are forsaken as senses dulled from murky dark awaken. Sun rays dazzle and coruscate as hungry lungs insufflate, then closing lids on old wise eyes, again lets go. Sea turtle descends to safety in the depths below. Another moment gone. Thank you.
It's time for me to say thank you, and then please come back. Thank you all for being here today, for sharing your exquisite poetry, and for a good reading and a wonderful wave that we just sent out around the world.